This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, in advance of the conventions, we're featuring interviews about presidential history and politics. Today, we're going to hear from four former press secretaries. Together, they represented each president from Ronald Reagan to George W. Bush. We'll hear stories of spinning, stonewalling, denying, and passing out information that turned out to be false. Up first, Marlon Fitzwater. He says that while serving as press secretary to Presidents Reagan and Bush, he developed three rules: cave early and often, grovel if you have to, and you can run and hide. I spoke to him in 1995, after the publication of his memoir, Call the Briefing, in which he described what it's like to stand between the opposing forces of the president and the press corps. He was in that tight spot during momentous events like the Iran-Contra hearings and the Gulf War. And for less historic occasions, like when President George H.W. Bush threw up in the lap of the Japanese prime minister. Fitzwater says he thought of his daily White House briefings as psychological warfare.
I used to plan for the press briefing for 2 or 3 hours every day. And a big part of that planning was to sit down with my staff and say, okay, what's the mood of the press corps? Give me a feedback. I want you to circulate among them, find out, you know, who had a bad night, who's getting a divorce, who's angry with the president, who thinks we're nuts to be doing this. And so that by the time I go out there at 11 o'clock, I want to know what these people are thinking, what their attitudes are, and where they're coming from. And as it turns out, the press is back in the back of the room doing the same thing about me. They're asking each other, you know, is Marlon in a good mood today? Is this going to be a contentious kind of briefing, or is it going to be fun? Do we have a lot of issues to deal with, or only one? And so there's a very psychological battle that goes on, and both sides get ready for it.
Now, you didn't allow your press briefings to be recorded for broadcast. Why not?
Well, mainly because if I said something stupid, I didn't want to repeat it every 15 minutes on camera. And that's the honest reason. The more institutional reason is that I felt it gave me the freedom to answer questions a little more fully if I didn't have to worry about how it appeared on television. Because on TV, you have to maintain a certain presence and dignity, whereas there were times where I wanted to argue with the press corps. I wanted to convince them we were right, and that didn't always call for a good television picture.
Now, as press secretary, you sometimes have to cover up for presidential gaffes. In fact, in your memoir, you reprint a funny cartoon that has President Reagan saying, 2 + 2 = 5. And then it has you saying what the president really meant was.
Yes, the press is always eager to get you to amplify on the president's words or at least to acknowledge that he didn't quite know what he was saying. And after President Reagan's speeches, the press would always say, did the president really mean to say that this is the way the country was going? And finally, I just got around to saying the president said what he meant and meant what he said, and try to let it go at that. But there's always a kind of a second-day examination of everything the president said.
What is one of the gaffes you did have to cover up for?
Well, I don't know. I suppose maybe the most famous one with President Reagan, which actually Larry Speaks was the press secretary then, and I was his deputy. But when President Reagan did a radio broadcast from Santa Barbara and joked before the broadcast about, look out, Russia, the bombs are coming in 5 minutes. The whole government was having to cover up for that one. We had to call the Allies and tell them there wasn't any bombing happening. We had to call Russia and say, we're just kidding, folks. And we had to tell the press corps where the president was just joking. And it took us several days to get through that one.
After President Bush raised taxes in spite of his read my lips, no new taxes, you had to answer to that, too. How did you deal with that?
Well, it was a very disastrous decision for the president politically because it was interpreted by the American people as the president broke his pledge that he had made at the time of the convention. So it was a difficult issue to describe. Plus, our people in the White House never really faced up to kind of what the impact of that decision in terms of the president's pledge. And I think had we gone out right afterwards and said, look, this is a matter of conscience, and President Bush is trying to really do what Ronald Reagan said still needed to be done. We cut taxes, we made a strong defense, but we got a huge deficit that's got to be reduced. But instead, we never really got around to saying that very strongly. And that was a poor job, I think, on my part and everybody's part.
Now, after President Bush raised taxes, didn't you have to participate in calling those taxes revenue enhancers?
Well, the fellows...
To get around saying, oh, yes, these are really taxes.
Yeah, well, we didn't have to do that very long because the press took one look at their revenue enhancement language and within 2 nanoseconds understood it was a tax increase and we'd broken the pledge.
Was this your idea to use this euphemistic phrasing?
No, this was the phrasing that was worked out by the budget negotiators themselves, including the president and a senior team on our side, and then the Democratic side was George Mitchell and Foley and Gebhardt and others. And they worked out this language. And the minute I saw it, I said to our chief of staff, you know, this is not going to fly. But they said, look, we negotiated this, go do it. And sure enough, it didn't fly 2 feet.
What's it like for you when you have to say something that you don't really believe in?
Well, you have to do it intellectually. I mean, there were 2 or 3 major issues that were central to the policies of President Reagan and President Bush that I did disagree with personally. And I took some pride in the idea that after 10 years, there really was nobody in the press corps who could identify those issues because I had to argue them all intellectually. When you have no heart in it, you have no emotion in it, but yet you have to make the case for the president the best way you can if you're a professional spokesman.
Would you care to say what those issues were that you disagreed on?
I'd rather not, but they were major social issues of some prominence and litmus test issues, really, for President Reagan and President Bush.
Now, you sometimes had to do damage control on yourself. You sometimes said the wrong thing at a briefing, and one example is when you called Gorbachev a drugstore cowboy.
Yeah, I think that was the worst, really, of my tenure.
What did you mean by that? I mean, I think of I saw the movie Drugstore Cowboy, and in that, it's people who rob drugstores to steal prescription drugs so that they could get high on them. What did you mean by Drugstore Cowboy?
You saw a pretty updated version from what I was talking about, I'll tell you. No, but we were looking for a way to describe the Soviet Union in 1989, because Gorbachev kept making speeches that was promising arms control reductions of various kind. He said, I'll reduce my conventional forces in the Eastern Bloc countries. I'll reduce nuclear warheads by 1/3. And he was promising all these things, but he never submitted a concrete plan to our negotiators to get to work on. And we were trying to find a way to kind of smoke him out. And so I looked it up in the dictionary, and it said a drugstore cowboy is one who makes promises he doesn't keep. And I said, that's perfect. That's exactly what I want to say. And I read it to my staff, and I said, how about this? I'm going to say they throw out these arms control proposals like a drugstore cowboy. And my staff said, don't do it, Marlon. That's terrible. That's the dumbest thing we ever heard. But I was convinced it's right, and the opportunity presented itself, and I did it. And the minute I did it, I knew I was in trouble. I mean, the press laughed and groaned, you know, like they do when you tell a bad joke, because they knew they had me. And I had miscalculated, frankly, how personal that term is. And the press shortened it immediately to Fitzwater calls Gorbachev a drugstore cowboy, when in fact I had said that he throws out arms control proposals like a drugstore cowboy. And I should have known that, I of all people.
What would you say were the main differences between working as press secretary for President Reagan and President Bush?
Well, mainly their personal characteristics and how they chose to govern. The similarities were that they're both men of great dignity and honor and integrity and wonderful to work for. They were not shouters or screamers. They treated everybody with kindness. And in that sense, they were just terrific. The difference was that President Reagan liked his briefings in writing. If he had a decision to make, he'd want you to write it up, write down the options, give him the best arguments. He'd go home, he'd think about it, he'd come in the next morning with a check mark and say, that's it. And the result was that I could read the same briefing papers he read, and I knew what he knew, and I knew what his decisions were based on and what went into them. So I could be with President Reagan maybe 20% of the time during a day and know 80 or 90% of what he was doing and thinking. With President Bush, he liked oral presentations. He would bring people into his office, and they would discuss an issue, and he'd decide on the spot, okay, let's do this, let's do that, here's what I want to do. And so that I had to spend maybe 80% of my day with President Bush just to know what he was doing and thinking. So from a press secretary's standpoint, it was a lot more time-consuming and difficult to keep track of President Bush's activities.
What was it like to prepare President Reagan for his press briefings? What For his press conferences, how would you prepare him?
Well, President Reagan had 48 press conferences in 8 years, as opposed to President Bush, who had 280 press conferences in 4 years. But they were different kinds of press conferences. And President Reagan liked the kind that utilized the abilities that he had as an actor and that he had learned in years before in terms of staging and presence and so forth. He liked the big formal press conferences in the East Room. And he didn't like to do them more than about once every couple months or so. So usually by the time he did a press conference, there were a lot of issues to catch up on. And we would have formal rehearsals the night before a press conference where we would fire questions at President Reagan so that he would hear them in advance and could practice his answers. And he concentrated on his answers almost like an actor does with a script, almost like they were memorized. And you could see it as soon as he felt he got it right, he kind of pushed an inner button someplace, and that memory was locked away. And sure enough, the next night at the press conference, it would come back in the same form.
Is there a moment of your period as press secretary for Presidents Reagan and Bush that you would most like to do over again and get it right? I mean, something you blew, that you wish you could do over.
Well, I'd like to do two events over. I'd like to do the drugstore cowboy over that we talked about.
Uh-huh.
And there was an event during the campaign when I was totally frustrated and tired. We'd been 10 points behind for 4 months. We weren't getting any closer, and everything was going wrong. And I couldn't get the press to come outside and see this great rally with 20,000 Oklahoma people shouting about how great President Bush was. And the press was just kind of sitting back in the auditorium listening to it on the speaker. And I went in and said, "You lazy bastards, get out here and cover that event." And I've regretted that ever since.
How was that comment received by the press?
It was not received with great equanimity, no. They thought they were not very happy about it. And worst of all, I ruined the whole day for the president because all the stories were about Fitzwater's explosion. Fitzwater reflects the frustration of the campaign. Everything's going wrong. And I felt so sorry for President Bush. We had to go to 3 cities that day, and he had to go through all these speeches and all these handshakes and motions knowing he would get no press out of it because it was all going to focus on my mistake. And that was really a horrible feeling for a press secretary to have.
Marlon Fitzwater, recorded in 1995. Today we're featuring interviews with former White House press secretaries. Joe Lockhart was President Clinton's press secretary from October of 98 to October 2000. He took over from Mike McCurry just in time for a White House nightmare, the impeachment. In addition to the impeachment, Lockhart handled such stories as the bombing of Kosovo and the custody battle for Elian Gonzalez. I spoke to Lockhart in January 2001, right after President Clinton left office, and asked him to describe what happened the day he took over as press secretary.
The day I took over turned out to be the first day of the official impeachment. It was the day the House Judiciary Committee held their first formal hearing on the subject. So in addition to going up and standing in front of the cameras at the White House with a somewhat hostile press corps, there was actually an important piece of news that day. I like to describe my first briefing as an out-of-body experience because through most of it, I felt like I was standing 4 feet to my side watching me screw it up. As with anything, after you do it a couple times, you get a little more comfortable. And I think we all at the White House got more comfortable in that fight as it proceeded because I think we knew that the public was generally on our side, that the Republican leadership was pushing things too far and too hard.
Looking back, do you think you did screw up during that first press conference?
Oh, probably not. I mean, I think the president said to me some months later, and I took it as a compliment, something along the lines of, "You know, it's really nice that you've lost that deer in the headlights look." And, so I think there was an element of that. There was an element of sort of establishing my own credential with the press corps to be able to speak authoritatively for the president. And that was all of those things are natural for anyone coming in new. This was just accentuated a little bit, actually not a little bit, a lot, by the fact that we were beginning the formal impeachment proceedings.
Is there an example of a statement you made or the way you handled a turn in the impeachment story that you think was particularly effective in framing the story?
Well, I'll give you one that may seem trivial, but to me it was a it was an important one, and this was near the end, where you know, I think we had beaten back the charge of impeachment, and it looked like it was finally going to die under its own weight in the Senate. And immediately there was a groundswell of concern and stories about, well, will the White House be doing, you know, a celebratory dance, and will they gloat? And, I heard this for 2 days in a row from the reporters, and just, you know, out of nowhere, just decided and said and unilaterally declared that post-impeachment the White House would be a gloat-free zone. And I, you know, sort of took some heat from that inside about being so glib. But it actually, like many things here in town, it's not what happens. It's the lead-up and the anticipation. And it sort of took the issue off the table. That's a small sort of anecdotal. I think to answer the larger question, every single day of the impeachment battle, I felt my challenge was to frame this as a political power issue. That the Republicans were doing this because they had political differences with the president and were exercising their political power. And I think, by and large, that is the way the public, or the majority of the public, ultimately viewed this.
Well, shortly after the impeachment, you had to handle the story of the bombing in Kosovo.
Yeah, I mean, that, people ask me what was the hardest thing I had to do during my tenure as White House press secretary. And I think they don't believe me when I say it wasn't impeachment. And I think they think I'm just trying to put it on something that ended better or was more favorable for the president. But it really wasn't impeachment, because impeachment was a raw political battle, which from a communications point of view, we were in a pretty good position to fight. Kosovo was much more difficult. This was something that was very important. Most of us felt very strongly that it was the right thing to do. And we did a miserable job initially of convincing people that what we were doing was right and that it was going to work. And there were a lot of reasons for that. One is that this wasn't like the Gulf War, where you had the ability to show what you were doing. We were doing this in a place where Milosevic had control of state television there, had control of all the pictures, so really could dictate the storyline out of there. We had a really unprecedented political environment here in Washington, where from even before we started, there was not the general bipartisan support for a military action. There was partisan sniping that started even before we started. And there was, within the military, people who did not believe that an air campaign alone would work. They argued that strongly internally, and many of them argued it anonymously and just as strongly in the newspapers externally. So there was a real challenge there that and very frustrating, because we knew what we were doing was right. We were reasonably certain what we were doing would work, but almost from the moment that it started, it faced very deep skepticism.
You would often joke with the press at briefings. Did any of your jokes ever get you into trouble?
Occasionally. I made a joke. One of the first things I did after I was announced as the new press secretary is I missed a flight. And I made a joke about it at the expense of the president. And
what'd you say?
It was during the period where he had said something quite serious about, trying to make up for the damage he had done to his family during this period. And I sort of used those words to talk about the damage I had done in missing the plane. Something that the reporters all thought was hilarious. I don't think the president thought it was that funny. It's a fine line. Humor is probably one of the best weapons you can use in sort of disarming a aggressive press corps. It's particularly useful when you can do it at your own expense rather than someone else's expense. But there are times when, in trying to loosen things up, that you go a little bit over the line, and, it you generally have to pay for those.
One last question. Because the press secretary now is on TV all the time holding briefings, you become something of a celebrity yourself. And I'm wondering, when strangers meet you in the street and recognize you, what are the one or two things that they most often say to you about yourself or about the president?
The odd thing is that most people who you come up to on the street think they know you but don't know why they know you. They think that you went to high school or college with them. And there's a lot of them are very surprised when you tell them, you know, well, this is why you know me. The ones that do recognize you, generally 95% of them are self-selected positive people who will tell you that they enjoyed your work or they love the president. There's very few people who come up and are nasty. But I think the overwhelming response over the last year, at least, or the overwhelming question is, and it, no matter where I am in the country, I get this, is, what do you think of CJ, and is West Wing realistic? And luckily for CJ and West Wing, I think she's great, and I like the show.
Joe Lockhart served as President Clinton's press secretary. I spoke with him in January 2001. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, as part of our series of interviews on presidential history and politics, we're featuring interviews with former White House press secretaries. As press secretary during President Bush's first 2.5 years in office, Ari Fleischer had to respond to the press after the 9/11 attacks and in the lead-up and early days of the Gulf War. I spoke with him in 2005, after the publication of his memoir, Taking Heat. I bet when you took the job as White House press secretary, you weren't expecting to become a wartime press secretary. Where were you when you first heard on September 11th that the first plane had crashed into the tower of the World
Trade
Center?
I was with the president. I traveled with him just about everywhere he went. And so I was in the motorcade. We were just getting out of a school and out of the motorcade to go to a school event in Sarasota, Florida. And I was literally about five cars behind the president's limo. And I got a page telling me the first tower had been hit.
How'd you hear about the second plane?
Second plane, I got another page halfway through that event where the president was participating in a reading event with the little children, and it said the second tower's been hit. And I knew instantly that it had to be terrorism, and moments later, Andy Card walked into the room. I was about 10 feet on the left of the president. Andy Card walked into the room and whispered in the president's ear that the second tower's been hit. America's under attack.
So many Americans are surprised, confused, by the fact that the president stayed in his chair,
right,
and kept listening to the children read after hearing that America was under attack. What you did actually was write a sign and hold it up to the president.
Correct.
What did the sign say?
I wrote a sign on the back of a notepad that said, "Don't say anything yet," because I thought until the president can get a proper briefing, he should not say what he was planning on saying before, because now this is not an accident. This must be terrorism. And the first words that the American people get from the president shouldn't be something where he is not yet armed with information. Nothing would have changed if he did bolt from his chair and leave, other than if he had gotten up from that chair looking scared or spooked. I think it would have scared and spooked the nation. He remained calm, left the room. Now, in those 7 minutes, it allowed people to figure out what was happening to the best degree we could. But still, no one knew about the other two aircraft, or if they did, no one had passed that on to anybody who was in a position to pass it on to the president. And so still, we thought it was those two aircraft only. So even 7 minutes later, we're in the holding room right next to the little schoolroom, classroom, and the president's working the phones, Andy Carter's working the phones, and an official from the National Security Council who always traveled with us is working the phones, trying to figure out what's going on. Not a word about the other two aircraft, not a word about them being hijacked. I don't know off the top of my head if they had been hijacked yet at that very moment. And then the president made the decision that we were going to leave to go back to Washington. He left then to go address a larger group that he was supposed to give a big speech to, and said in a speech that several people said he looked nervous. And he said in that speech that he's going to leave, return to Washington, the nation's been attacked. And you hear a lot of shock in the room. People didn't know it. And at that point, we headed back into the motorcade to go to Air Force One, presumably for Washington at that moment.
But is what you're saying that the president was basically irrelevant in the first few minutes after the second attack, that the president could afford to not be in the loop, that other people were working the phones and the president didn't matter, he could just stay listening? I mean,
Well, no, actually, the president, too, was working the phones. If I didn't say that, I'm
mistaken. Well, no, not during the minutes he was in the chair, which is the minutes we're talking about.
Well, clearly not in those minutes that he was in the chair. But keep in mind also, the president is not the finder of facts. The finders of facts are more aligned, I'd put it, the colonels and lieutenant colonels who work at the National Security Council and at the Department of Defense or the Federal Aviation Administration. Those are the people who are on the front lines, who are in communication with what's happening on the ground. And that information then filters up to the president through either his National Security Advisor or Andy Card or wherever it comes from.
During the lead-up of the invasion of Iraq, you were asked a lot about weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And one of the things you said, March 21st, 2003, well, there is no question that we have evidence and information that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, biological and chemical. All this will be made clear in the course of the operation for whatever duration it takes. Do you feel that you participated in what some critics have called the hyping of weapons of mass destruction?
Absolutely
to,
not.
Generate more support for going into Iraq?
Absolutely not. The job of the press secretary is to faithfully articulate what the government is doing and why it's doing it at the time it's doing it. And all you can do is work off of the best information available at the time. And that is loyally what I did. I articulated accurately what we thought and what we knew at the time. Now, I wish we could figure out what went wrong. Why were we wrong? And what does it say about Iran and North Korea? Are we overestimating or underestimating those nations? That, to me, is the lesson that has to be learned from the mistakes we made.
The White House Press Corps, many of the members of the White House Press Corps have been very critical of the Bush administration's tight control over information and its steadfastness in staying on point, on message. A couple of quotes. David Gregory of NBC, "My biggest frustration is that this White House has chosen an approach with the White House Press Corps, generally speaking, to engage us as little as possible." Elizabeth Buemiller of the New York Times, "Too often they treat us with contempt. In comparison, the Reagan administration coddled us. This crowd has a wall up. They never get off their talking points." Legitimate complaints?
Well, I don't think so. I think what really there is frustration in the press about the way the Bush administration deals with the press. But I think most of it stems from the fact that the press, again, are trained to break the next big story, and that they break the news first before the president does. The president said to me and to others in the White House, he thinks his job is to make the news, and he doesn't want to read about it in the newspapers or see it on TV before he himself publicly says it. This president is surrounded by people who don't go out of a closed meeting, give reporters tips, and say, "Here's what the president is about to do in 2 hours. I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give it to you." We try to treat all the press the same way, treat them fair, make the news at the same time, and the president is the one who wants to make the news. And that can be frustrating for reporters.
Well, I think they also want more than the official press release. They want to know what people are really saying and thinking, what's going on. And I think that the complaint here was that information, the control of information, is really tight.
But I think they still get that. I mean, everybody knew that Colin Powell had initially had objections about the war in Iraq. That really came through. People saw in the Arab-Israeli matters that the state had a different view than perhaps the vice president and others. It still gets out there. The 20 years I've been in business, reporters have always had levels of complaints about government and government information. In fact, in President Bush's father's administration, nobody could keep any news quiet. Everything was given to the press. One faction would fight against another faction, and the press absolutely loved it. That's how they get a lot of good insider tips. And then they write stories that said White House in disarray. You don't get any stories about a White House that say White House in array. Instead, you get the flip side of it is the White House is secretive. And I think it's part of the thesis of my book that the press is always going to find something to cover that's conflict-oriented, but they are seldom to give praise.
You know how President Bush sometimes misspeaks a little bit?
I've noticed.
Right. Well, one of those, I think, was about, I'm not going to remember the quote offhand, but in talking about how he needs to, like, hug the widows and hug the family, he made a little bit of a gaffe in the way he said it. I don't know if you remember this quote, and I wish I had a better memory and could quote it to you. But I was wondering if it becomes your job on occasions where there is a little bit of a gaffe to fix it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, in fact, I remember once, this was June of 2003, and the president was in the Roosevelt Room, and he was asked a question. This is the aftermath of the war, and now the guerrilla attacks and the frequency of the soldiers dying start to increase. And he was asked a question about all the attacks on our troops. And he said, "My message to those who want to attack our troops is bring it on." And as we walked back in the Oval Office, I said to him, "Mr. President, think of how that sounds to the to a mother who's got a child fighting for us over there. I mean, bring it on. And he said to me that all he meant to say was he has so much faith in our military that if anybody wants to attack us, that bring it on. Our military is the best, and anybody who attacks us is probably going to lose their life. I said, but it didn't come across that way, sir. And I think he got it and got it instantly. My job was to say to the president, it was easy to do, Mr. President, I would do it this way or that way, and to help correct him in private. It didn't mean that I would go out to the press and say, boy, did he screw up. Let me tell you what he just did. Sometimes a good advisor is a good advisor on the inside, and a good president is a president who will listen.
So how do you like life outside of the White House now? Do you watch the White House briefings every day?
You know, I read them every day, but I think I've only watched one or two of Scott's briefings, but I read his briefings every day.
Not your favorite television show?
Well, I remember the day after I left the White House, I was on a treadmill working out in the middle of the afternoon, getting back into shape, and Scott's briefing came on TV, and my first reaction was, whoo, I wouldn't want to be in that guy's shoes.
Ari Fleischer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ari Fleischer, recorded in 2005. We conclude our series of interviews with former White House press secretaries with Scott McClellan. Last spring, he published a memoir that was critical of the Bush administration and what McClellan describes as Washington's culture of deception. McClellan describes himself as someone who had been a Texas loyalist, a trusted member of the president's senior-most team of advisors. He first worked for Bush in 1999 as his gubernatorial spokesman. He was a traveling press secretary for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign, and during President Bush's first term was chief deputy to Press Secretary Ari Fleischer. He served as President Bush's press secretary from July 2003 through May 2006. I spoke with McClellan in June when his memoir was published. Now, one of the things you write about in the book is how the White House would enlist the help of conservative talk show hosts and other, quote, friends in the media, conservative columnists, talk radio personalities, and they'd be given communications packets with comprehensive talking points. How does that work?
That's right. No, I mean, you pretty much just summed it up. We had a massive operation in the White House, massive political operation. It was not new. It certainly existed before us. I think to some extent we took it to new lengths, and Karl Rove, of course, being the senior advisor. But everything was well coordinated amongst some of the political operation in the Office of Strategic Initiatives, for example, as well as the White House communications operation. And when we need to get information out. We've got a whole long list of conservative allies and friends, whether it's talk radio, whether it's columnists in the newspapers. And it's all part of that effort to shape the media narrative to our advantage.
I'd like to play one or two of the more dramatic moments of your press conferences and talk about what was happening in your mind or behind the scenes at this time. And this was, I think, a particularly uncomfortable press briefing for you. You had been telling the press that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby assured you that they had nothing to do with leaking Valerie Plame Wilson's name and that she was a CIA operative. Then the story broke that Rove did talk about her with at least one reporter. The reporters at the press briefing were asking you about that, and you refused to comment, saying you couldn't comment on an ongoing investigation. And then the reporters were saying, well, why couldn't you comment on it now when you seemed free to comment on it earlier when what you were saying was, no, they didn't know anything.
Right.
So here's David Gregory questioning you July 11th, 2005.
Scott, can I ask you this? Did Karl Rove commit a crime?
Again, David, this is a question relating to an ongoing investigation, and you have my response related to the investigation. And I don't think you should read anything into it other than we're going to continue not to comment on it while it's ongoing.
Do you stand by your statement from the fall of 2003 when you were asked specifically about Carl and Elliot Abrams and Scooter Libby, and you said, I've gone to each of those gentlemen, and they have told me they are not involved in this. Do you stand by that statement?
And if you will recall, I said that as part of helping the investigators move forward on the investigation, we're not going to get into commenting on it. That was something I stated back near that time as well.
Scott, this is ridiculous. The notion that you're going to stand before us after having commented with that level of detail and tell people watching this that somehow you decided not to talk, you've got a public record out there. Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said, and I will be glad to talk about it
at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when the investigation...
Why are you choosing when it's appropriate, when it's inappropriate?
If you'll let me finish.
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything. You stood at that podium and said that Karl Rove was not involved, and now we find out that he spoke about Joseph Wilson's wife. So don't you owe the American public a fuller explanation? Was he involved or was he not? Because contrary to what you told the American people, he did indeed talk about his wife, didn't he?
David, there will be a time to talk about this, but now is not the time to talk about it.
Do you think people will accept that, what you're saying today?
Again, I've responded to the question. Go ahead,
Terry. Okay, that was my guest Scott McClellan with David Gregory of NBC at a White House press briefing July 11th, 2005. Scott McClellan, so why couldn't you comment then?
Well, the short answer is that the White House counsel's office tied my hands, as they did anyone that was speaking publicly at the White House. They said, we're not going to talk about this. This is an ongoing legal proceeding, and you can't talk about it. I actually, back at that, shortly after that time, or even around that time, I told White House reporters that someday I looked forward to talking about this. And I think they came to realize that I was very sincere in that. That was an extremely difficult period because I could not defend what I had previously said about 2 years earlier. I did tell reporters 2 years prior to that that Scooter Libby and Karl Rove had both assured me that they were not involved in the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity. It's interesting how that came about. Part of that was conversations with Karl Rove. Karl Rove had also told the president he was not involved, and the president and I had a discussion about that. And then about a week later after the investigation broke, the president and vice president spoke and directed me to exonerate Scooter Libby as well as in addition to Carl because his name was coming up in some of the conversation and some of the Washington rumor mill. And I said the only way I will do that, told the chief of staff Andy Card, the only way I will do that is if Scooter Libby gives me the same assurances that Karl Rove did. And so I got Scooter on the phone. He was traveling with the vice president then and said asked him exactly what I asked Carl. Were you involved in this, the leaking of Valerie Plame's identity, in any way? And he said, no, absolutely not. Carl had given me the same assurances, unequivocal. No, we were not involved. And there's nothing more important for the press secretary than his credibility. And what the press secretary says has to be based on what he believes to be true. And it was back then. But then when it is found out that it's not true and you can't correct the record, that makes it extremely difficult to continue in that position. And over time, it would eventually be a chief reason why I left the White House. That really set in this period of disillusionment in me because I was rightly, as David did, battered for not being able to or for going into this no comment mode. It's a terrible position to be in for no comment is just a terrible communication strategy. You've got to be able to explain things and set the record straight when needed, particularly if something you said previously later turns out not to be the case.
I want to play another White House press briefing clip. And this is from October 13th, 2005. And here it's Helen Thomas, who is asking you the questions. And this is about the war in Iraq.
President Mita, what do you mean by total victory? That we will never leave Iraq until we have total victory. What does that mean?
Free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East, because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions.
If they ask us to leave, then we'll leave.
Okay, I'm trying to respond. Well, a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the broader Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions of al-Qaeda and their terrorist associates. They want to establish or impose their rule over the broader Middle East. We saw that in the Zawahiri letter that was released earlier this week by the intelligence community. Well, Helen, the president recognizes that we are engaged in a global war on terrorism. And when you're engaged in a war, it's not always pleasant, and it's certainly a last resort. But when you engage in a war, you take the fight to the enemy. You go on the offense, and that's exactly what we're doing. We are fighting them there so that we don't have to fight them here. September 11th taught us.
It had nothing to do with Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah, well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. The president recognizes this requires a comprehensive strategy and that this is a broad war, that it is not a law enforcement matter.
Sorry, on what basis do you say Helen is opposed to the broader war on terrorism?
Well, she certainly expressed her concerns about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years.
Speak for her, which is odd.
I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the course of the past couple of years, she has expressed her concerns.
Okay, so that was Helen Thomas and my guest Scott McClellan at a press briefing. Scott McClellan, was it a tactic when you or anyone else in the White House was getting tough, challenging questions to try to discredit the reporter asking the questions, in Helen Thomas's case, to say, well, sure, you're saying that because you don't believe in the broader war on terrorism? Or like when David Gregory was asking you after Hurricane Katrina if you had confidence, if Bush had confidence in the head of FEMA and the head of Homeland Security, and you kept accusing him of playing the blame game of finger-pointing, and he said, no, I want to know. It's a legitimate question. Do you have confidence in the head of FEMA and Homeland Security? And you kept saying, no, you're playing the blame game. So was that like a conscious tactic when someone's asking a question that seems challenging or, you know, negative, to try to discredit them or make it seem like they were being unpatriotic? Can you talk about that?
Well, I don't know so much about, at least from my standpoint, about unpatriotic, but yes, in terms of deflecting the question or maybe discrediting. I mean, certainly in the instance when you played with Helen Thomas, she is now an opinion columnist, and she has very strong opinions, and she is also a very good reporter. But absolutely, I mean, sometimes you're trying to deflect the question and maybe turn it back to where you'll be in the position where you're on the offensive instead of in this defensive crouch. And other times, like with Helen Thomas, you're trying to turn it back to the broader message we were trying to get across at the time, which was that what I said in response to her about fighting them over there instead of fighting them over here and things of that nature.
Let's talk about Iraq. You write a lot about the lead up to a war in Iraq and what came afterwards in your book. One of the things you write is that Bush and then Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld decided to update the Pentagon's war plans for Iraq in November 2001. In effect, you say, Bush had already made the decision to go to war, even if he convinced himself it might still be avoided. You say war was inevitable, given the course of action the president set from the beginning. Bush managed the crisis in a way that almost guaranteed that the use of force would become the only feasible option. Are you saying that this was intentional to make sure that there was no other option, that Bush did things like give an ultimatum at the UN, order a massive buildup of American arms and military forces in the region to make sure that no matter what Congress wanted, no matter what the UN said, there was no choice but to go to war?
Well, he left himself no flexibility whatsoever, and I think his advisors served him poorly in that way. The president should always maintain some flexibility, but it goes to what you just brought up, that the president really had, I would come to learn, made his decision. And it's the way President Bush operates or approaches policy. He tends to be an instinctive player and make the policy decision early on and then say, how do we go about implementing this? And the policy decision he made early on was that we're going to confront Saddam Hussein, and not too long after 9/11, we're going to confront Saddam Hussein. We're going to remove his regime unless he comes fully clean. And I don't think, reflecting back on this, I think it was probably unreasonable to expect that Saddam Hussein was going to be the kind of guy, given his past, that would just come fully clean and say, okay, come into my country and you can go all over it and do whatever you want.
You write that you finally figured out that the decision to go to war was based largely on the desire within the Bush administration to overthrow Saddam Hussein and then spread democracy through the Middle East. The dream of a democratic Middle East, you say, was the most powerful force behind Bush's drive to war. But, you say, Bush and his advisors knew that the American people would most certainly not support a war launched primarily for the ambitious purpose of transforming the Middle East. And then you say that rather than open this Pandora's box about spreading democracy through the Middle East, because that would raise all kinds of questions,
right,
that instead the Bush administration tried to make the WMD threat larger than it was. They tried to make the Iraqi connection to terrorism appear more certain than it was. They quietly ignored or disregarded some of the crucial caveats in the intelligence, minimized evidence that pointed in the opposite direction. They used innuendo and implication to encourage Americans to believe things that were unclear or possibly false about Iraq. A lot of people have said this, but you're saying it from having been within the inner circle. Tell us something that led you to these conclusions that only somebody within the inner circle would know about.
Well, when I became press secretary, I participated in many world leader meetings with the president and saw up close in these small group settings how passionately the president believed in the freedom agenda, believed in transforming the Middle East as a key component of the war on terrorism. And over the course of time, I came to learn that that was really what was driving his decision-making on Iraq and his belief. And it's also something that probably clouds some of his judgment today in terms of being able to recognize some of the larger realities of the problems that we have faced over the course of time being in there. But one of the themes in the book that I talk about is how dangerous it can become when you take this permanent campaign, this political campaign mentality, and transfer that over to the war-making decision process or war-making campaign process. When you engage too much in trying to sell the war and you get caught up in doing what you would do for any political campaign or any other domestic policy issue and start overstating or overpackaging the case, then it becomes very dangerous later on. And we saw that because we weren't as open and forthright as we should have been. And then it turned out that a lot of what we were saying was wrong.
Scott McClellan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Scott McClellan served as White House press secretary under President Bush. Our interview was recorded in June after the publication of his memoir. Our series on presidential history and politics concludes tomorrow. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.